Hi, this is Christopher Cherry, co-producer of the Toronto 48-Hour Film Project. And if there is one film I could remake, it would be Soylent Green.
48 hours to go. If you're looking for a hero, then this is the show. Where did they come from? What do they know? It's an origin story. Let's go.
Get a sip of my weird energy drink concoction.
That sounds weird. A weird energy drink concoction. That sounds like
yeah, I get it. Sugar-free rock star with some raspberry airborne tablets in it.
I don't know what that sounds yum.
That's sugar-free energy drink. Lots of B vitamins and get my C and all that.
Yes. Yeah. Nice.
Well, anyway, hi, I'm Kirk Nordstrom. I am the co-producer of the Seattle and Montana 48-Hour Film Projects.
And I'm Indra, and I'm from the Netherlands, and I'm city producer for three cities over there.
Very happy to be here with you, Indra, today, because we got a very interesting episode coming up and some fun news about the 48-Hour Film Project world. And if I could go first, I have a big announcement.
Go for it.
Well, as of yesterday, Chris and I put the digital ink on a contract, which makes us the new city producers for the San Francisco 48-Hour Film Project.
That's amazing and so exciting.
I am really, really excited because I grew up in the Bay Area. I grew up in Los Gatos, California, which is a suburb of San Jose. And San Francisco is my favorite city in the whole world. Really, really, really excited and happy to dig in and make that city as big as I think it should be, because it really should be one of the triple digit 48 cities.
Oh, and if any pair can make that work, make that happen, it's you and Chris. And I'm so thrilled for you guys, and I'm absolutely sure it's going to be an amazing success. And if you're listening from San Francisco or that area, make sure you join this, because these guys will organize something amazing.
Oh yeah, I can't wait. And just any excuse to get me into the city.
You have it now.
Oh yeah. I get to see all my old friends and go to my favorite food places and just all the sights and crazy, crazy smells of that city.
I'm sure it's going to be awesome.
You've got a big week coming up.
I know. So at the time of recording, it is Sunday, and this Friday, we'll be kicking off the 48-Hour Film Project in Arnhem, city in the Netherlands, and it's one of the four cities that will be kicking off the 2022 worldwide tour. So we're super excited, woohoo, indeed, to start off and be the first city in the Netherlands. And it's the first time in Arnhem. And we've got about 18 teams that will be competing. I'm so thrilled and I can't wait. And my partner in crime and co-producer, Wouter, has been working hard on getting the technical stuff ready. I'm getting everything else ready. And I just want it to be Friday so we can get started.
So I'm going to schedule our next recording sessions for, let's see here, how about next Sunday at about 5 p.m. your time. Would that work for you?
There might be a better time.
No, even better. 6 p.m. your time on Friday. There we go.
Oh, yeah, fine. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, sure.
Just to make it even more stressful.
That's totally fine. I mean, Walter can do the kickoff by himself. That's totally fine. Nah, it's the best moment for us as studio producers, I think. One of the best moments to do the kickoff, to see everybody freak out about the genre they get. And all the elements that we come up with. So yeah, I can't wait. So exciting.
Yeah. I'm wishing you all the best of luck, and I can't wait to see what aggravatingly good films come out of your city.
I'm very curious to see the same thing. And, speaking of, what city producers do. So our guest this week is Christopher Cherry, one of the two producers of Toronto in Canada. And we had a really cool conversation with him, didn't we?
It's something that we've tried to bring up pretty actively over the course of doing this podcast, is that, when you're watching a television show, you're watching a movie, I think television brings it home even more. when you have 500 channels at your disposal, and every single one of those channels at some point during the hour is going to do a credit scroll. And sometimes, you know, there are dozens to hundreds of people in that credit scroll. And all of those people, except for maybe some of the interns, are getting paid, you know, making a living doing this. There's so many different roles to do on a film, and not just on a film, but in the industry, whether you're on set or not. And I attribute a lot of the success of my career as, you know, a post-production person to running the 48-hour film project in Seattle for, you know, 17 years. I've met a lot of people. It's elevated my visibility a lot. I've actually been recognized, like in grocery stores. Hey, you're the 48 guy. Whoa, yeah.
Let's be honest here. You do have a pretty recognizable look.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey. I've been six foot four since I was 14. So I've always kind of stood out in the crowd. But yeah, I mean, I've gotten a lot of work indirectly because of the 48, but the 48 has taught me to be a social creature, something that I'm not naturally inclined to.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And I relish personal interaction, and especially, you know, at my events prior to the 48, during the 48, after the 48, interacting with and maintaining and growing the communities, but also our Filmapalooza family, our city producer family.
Absolutely. And I think, and that's something that Chris talks about later on as well, is maintaining those social connections that you make within the 48. They can get you to places where you can actually work on a film set or on a production and actually make a living doing this, as he is doing right now. He will tell us about this later. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
He's worked on some very cool stuff. For me personally, I have a really thriving business, which I basically built from being at the 48, meeting people through going to screenings, being at the award shows, attending the meet and greets. So that's always a very cool thing and very good thing to do for your networking. Because we work in an industry, it's about who you know, right? Yeah. And it's the same in the Netherlands, it's the same in the US. It works just about the same way. And I think the 48 has a really important part in bringing people together, whether it is in the same team, whether it is at the event, whether it is that one CD producer gets introduced to another. And I think Chris is a very nice example of that, and on how, you know, you can make a living doing this, but also be part of the 48.
Yeah, yeah. Chris and Steve and I have talked about working together to bring another Canadian city online for the 48 that's a little closer to me than it is to them. But there's a lot of wrangling involved, you know, international legal wrangling involved in that.
I bet.
And, you know, you and I are internationally producing a podcast together.
Yeah.
And it's the social aspect of the 48 that's made this happen.
Absolutely.
And as we're talking with Chris, he's got middle child syndrome. He's a middle child in his family. And when we went and got our tattoos, I insisted on going first because I'm the longest running city producer in 48 hour history.
Yes, yes.
And I think by 1 year at this point.
And that's, doesn't matter. It's still number one.
That's only due to the pandemic. That's only because of the pandemic. I was able to leapfrog someone. But yeah, he got the second tattoo and you got the third.
Yep.
So we had to kind of comfort him about his middle child syndrome.
Yes, apparently it was very traumatic for him, and it is still. So, you know, send your support out to Chris, our middle brother, which makes me the little sister with two big brothers. And I'm the eldest of four in my family. I have one younger sister and two younger brothers. I've always wanted an older brother, and with the 48, I got two of them, which is just perfectly lovely.
Yeah, and I'm the younger of two, and my brother is about the same He's 7.5 years older than me. So I have a very similar age disparity that Chris does with his older sister. So, you know, it's nice to be the big brother.
I can totally believe you. So shall we take a listen to what Chris has to say and what we talk about?
Yeah. Let's dive in and hear some wisdom from my maple syrup brother in Toronto, Canada. One Christopher Cherry. Enjoy.
It's an origin story. Let's go.
Oh, well, welcome everyone to 48 Hour Heroes Origin Stories. I'm here with my co-producer, Indra van het Hooft from Arnhem, Netherlands. And today, our special guest is long overdue. It is Christopher Cherry.
Woo!
So hello. Who the hell are you? Who the hell are you and why am I talking to you?
I don't know why you're talking to me.
I ask myself that question a lot.
I'm not sure why we're friends. At all. I am the producer co-producer for the Toronto 48 Hour Film Project, as well as Steve Nash up here in Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So when did you start doing Toronto?
I think we have a slight confusion as to like where the timeline actually goes. I believe it was 2009. We've looked back and I think we figured out it was 2009 that we started, but we had participated before we had started. So we had done 2 years before. So it's where do we like technically say how long we've been involved? Pretty much the last 15 years of my life, the 48 Hour Film Project has been involved.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of where we measure it. It's like it's 15 years in Toronto, 13 years since we took over producing it. As far as it kind of goes within Toronto, they both like Steve and I people kind of just know it as it's not the Toronto 48 Hour Film Project without us.
Yeah.
Like there wasn't before. Not that there was, but there was only 2 years and each year only had 10 teams.
Wow. Only 10 in Toronto. That is so crazy.
When we took over, it was mainly under the guise of, we're like, this is a really, really cool thing. This should be huge in Toronto.
Yes. Yes.
There's no way that this should be only getting just to the double digits. The very low end of the double digits. It should just be out of single digits. Like this should be huge. This should be the biggest, one of the biggest things in Toronto. It should be an annual event. And I think our record says it all. We put a lot of work into the early years to push it, but right out of the mat, we even doubled the festival like our first year, flying by the seat of our pants, like running around chickens with their head cut off, trying to figure out how to do this all, and kind of making it up as we go. From then on, it was doubling and then growing a bit and doubling and growing a bit, and our biggest year being before COVID, of course.
that was a big year because for years. You and Steve and I would always like, okay.
Oh yeah.
I'm going to top Toronto this year. And you guys are like, no, we're going to get you.
It was an unwritten thing that we had this competition together to try and outdo each other. Again, it was a friendly competition.
Yeah, of course.
We're both supportive, but yeah. But
it was then 2020 or 2019.
2019.
Dude, you guys blew up. What?
124.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah. And
from 80.
Yeah. Yeah. But the year before we had thought, okay, maybe we're going to max out because we kind of had a vague understanding of how we double and how things grow and we could see trends. And so the year before we knew we were 70s or something like that. It was 72 the year before, two previous years to that. And then that next year, we're like, okay, maybe we'll probably hit about 90. So we thought we would, we thought we hit 90 and we kind of made 88. And then 5 days before the kickoff, we had, I think we had 15 still on the waiting list and we were maxed out.
Oh, wow.
Crazy.
So we were like, okay. And I remember getting a call from head office. Like, it was actually funny because Steve was on the phone with Mark and I was texting with Christina. Because she's like, well, is there any way you guys can, like, can we get another screening time in order to be able to fit this? And so, yeah, it was just like, it just took us a little bit. And then next thing you know, we ended up getting the slot and we opened it back up. And I forget exactly what we were, but I think it was about 96. So that's 96. So then that's kind of what led us to the following year being like, all right, well, we feel like we're going to go over 100 at this point. And we weren't expecting what actually did happen, but yeah.
What do you think? What did you guys do? I mean, you had to have done something. What changed? I mean, in those 2 years, you must have been doing something different, a little more aggressive.
I think it had a lot to do with more of like the word of mouth is out there, especially within Toronto. Toronto's like film community is the biggest, largest, smallest community there is, because of the amount of participation that you have. And when you're having about, like, you know, even like say like the year we had over 90 teams in there, you know, you average that out about, like, yeah, that's about 1,000 people across the city making film, right?
If you use the international averages, that's almost 1,500.
So exactly that word gets out. The thing is, like, you know, there's places, like there's rental agencies, like we have Alana McQuaid, that you're not allowed to reserve boom poles during the 48 weekend.
Yes.
It's for first come, first serve. I got yelled at by somebody trying to do a commercial who wasn't really in, like, too much aware about the 48, that she couldn't find a boom pole or a boom operator for this little commercial that she was doing. And she's like, yeah, it's because of this 48 going on. And I'm sitting there having a drink and I'm laughing to myself, like, oh my God, yep, that's me.
Wow,
we as city producers, we all are. So we know, you know, how much management of people comes into the factor of doing this. And then if you have like 100 teams, you have 100 team leaders that all want stuff from you. How do you and Steve, like, manage that?
There's a lot of phone calls. Again, with the growing the way we did with the doubling as it happened, and it kind of like happened gradually enough that we have enough repeat people that we've already dealt with them earlier on. Like, right. We've already gone over all their stuff. So we know going into it that, like, we only have probably about a 40% that are really going to have new questions, like new old questions. So we kind of
never a new question, always new old question.
Again, it's only the ones that are really new that we do end up dealing with. Like, we have had some other issues, but like usually our issues are like, oh, you know, fire trucks came and. Or like, you know, the cops came and that kind of stuff.
A moose bit someone.
Yeah.
They just wander the streets of Toronto. Everyone knows this.
We did have a murderous chicken. So yeah, that was
elaborate. Elaborate, please.
I think it was last year. It was either last year or the year before. Again, and during COVID, we still did even remarkably well. We still did like 70 and 80.
Damn,
respectively. Yeah, like, for being all online as well.
Wow.
One of my favorite filmmakers that we have, Jarrett Johnson, he did this movie called Clucked. I know Kirk would love it. Andrew, you would laugh, definitely like it, but I know Kirk would see the reference as far as like the like Evil Dead, like Sam Raimi approach to things, where it basically the camera, the point of view is from The Murderous Chicken.
I can picture it already. Like the zooming through the woods cam in Evil Dead 2.
Zooming through the woods and like, you know, like getting to this one girl and she's like, but I'm a vegan.
I want to see this. We need to get this link so we can also post it for the listeners. Watch this.
If he hasn't put it up online, I have it. I will send it to you. You gotta see it. But yeah, it's fun, but it's got that whole Sam Raimi, like over the top, like horror.
Nice. Oh, I gotta see this.
But no murderous moose is walking around Toronto. We're a little too far south for that, you know. You know, our main animal is raccoons and squirrels. So
yeah.
We are the number one in the world for a raccoon population.
Really?
Yeah, in Toronto. We were on, it was on a, I believe it was a David Attenborough.
Wow.
There's a whole little segment about Toronto and our raccoon population.
Wow, it doesn't get much more definitive than that right there.
Well,
it must be true.
I've actually been trying to work on a mascot for Toronto, and it's going to be a raccoon.
Huh? Nice.
Cool.
Nice. A filmmaking raccoon, I was thinking, yeah. like an auteur with like the old style, like the 20s style with the phone, the white scarf, the beret. I'm just not that artistically inclined.
Well, I couldn't believe it. So I live near the SeaTac airport. So I don't live in Seattle proper. I'm in a suburb out by the airport. And because of, you know, our dog Darby, she likes to get me up at very inopportune times of the morning. And so I'll take her out for a drive and listen to my podcasts. And I've lived here for 7 years now. And just the other day I saw coyotes.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
You know, we're just outside of Seattle. I would never expect coyotes to be out here, but sure enough, we have coyotes.
Yeah. We have coyotes in the city here too. Yeah.
So weird. Never thought of them as urban dwelling animals, but.
Well, I a lot of ours happened during COVID that everyone was kind of, like inside that the wild space is kind of open. It was really, you know, you see deer just like off to the side. You'd be walking down the street and there's a bunch of deer now.
Wow.
Like they're living in urban areas, you know? And so like, again, with the raccoon population, it would like, cause usually they have a territory of about 2 kilometers but in Toronto, it's different. So they actually are so much more smushed together that they've lost some of their main big territory roots.
Yeah.
So yeah. And you hear them all the time. You hear them out there.
They make weird noises.
Screaming away. Yeah.
But okay, so you guys got up to 120. I mean, and even though, you know, Seattle's not going to come close to that in the next couple of years, but
you have the same bigger population, don't you?
No. I mean, Seattle's under 1 million people.
You're under 1 million. I thought you were over.
Nope. Seattle, our metropolitan area is probably, you know, 3 million. So, I mean,
that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you're also, I mean, much more of a hub for your industry. I mean, Toronto is definitely the broadcast hub and definitely a large, you know, film industry hub.
Yeah. So. It is a huge industry. It's like one of them. Number one industries in Toronto.
Yeah.
So like it's brought millions and billions into the city. Yeah. So
it's, you know, it's an industry you can make a living in, which I think kids today need to know.
And you can do the crappiest job on set and make a living. You make better than minimum wage. You make actually decent coin.
Yeah, you can get into a union and the benefits of that.
Yeah, we have about 4 different unions that run within Toronto, and it's and like I'm actually trying to get into the union as well, but I've been just doing certifications at the Wazoo, much like my American friends. I just got my gun toting license there, so. It's different in Canada. It's a lot about safety and in order to have it, you know, I'm not that I plan on buying a gun with any at any point. You know, it's just mainly less that I can handle the firearms if need be.
Yeah. So, okay. We've known each other for almost 10 years now.
If not. Yeah.
You know.
I'm gone with probably about.
It was 2013 Filmapalooza. That was when we met. So.
Was that really?
Yeah.
Well, that's the first one that, I think that's the first one we went to.
Yeah. In all this time, I've never known your, you know, cinematic journey. How did you get into this industry?
Well, I was born at a young age.
Ba-dum-bum. That's such an old-fashioned joke. Oh, my God.
I was born at a young age. And my stepmother said, well, okay, essentially it did come from, I was, 80s child. I was raised on the television, I come from very young parents and I have younger siblings and an older sibling. So my sister being 7 years older, my mom would be like, she's busy with my little brother, Joanne, watch your brother. And so I was always with my sister, and my sister was, only 7 years older than me. And so we'd sit down and watch TV, and that, I love television. And I've seen so much stuff. It drives my wife up the wall. Cause I can do work, other work. I'll have the TV on and I'll be on a phone call and I can have music in the background.
Yeah. Kasha and I do that as well.
I constantly need something on.
Yeah.
And so I'm always watching something. I can pay attention to more than one thing at the same time. So it's like I can be watching the television without watching it, but I know what's going on. Again, so growing up that way, and then in high school, kind of just became, photography became my thing. And I just kept seeing once you started looking through the, the world and through the lens and seeing what you were capturing and doing your best to try and capture what you're seeing in your eye, where you're seeing the beauty of the world. And that kind of just helped me focus in on cinematography kind of idea. And so it was more or less it was a project in high school, and I decided, I had access to a camera. It was VHS.
Yep, I remember those. I remember those.
Me too. I love that, young people. Me too.
I made a short film for my media class. It was the first media class there was, and I just made a short film.
Nice.
And it was all based on one of the very first way back when films of the silent film era called The Kiss, and it was two people kissing for an extended period of time.
How very film. French.
So yeah, I'm pretty sure it was French. But so I kind of based it on that. And I just made this short film and I was like, I loved it. And everybody was really supportive of it. And they were like, we think you're onto something. And so I ended up just starting making my own kind of guerrilla style films at the end of high school. And that was kind of it. And then a few years later, we won't go into a lot of details. I eventually picked back up and I went to film school. So out of film school, was in the bar industry and working downtown Toronto and, working on a few other shows and whatnot and stuff like that. And then I met this guy named Steve Nash and I threw another friend of ours and it was like, oh, hey, we kind of want to make a film collective, a film group, and almost like a book club, but we go out and make films. So we kind of organized it that 1 week we would sit down, we'd write a script, and then the next week we'd go out, we'd shoot it, and then the following week we'd edit it. So it was trying to get everybody kind of into the zone and that kind of stuff. And so we did numerous of one of those. And then lo and behold, I get a message from a high school friend of mine, Mike Adair. And he had sent me a message. He's like, hey, do you know about this? And it was the 48-hour film project.
Hey.
And I clicked that link and it was in, I think it was 3 weeks from that day, you know, I didn't have a lot of money at that point, and I just went, you know what, I'm going to do it. And so I had called Steve and Simeon and whatnot, and I said, hey, you guys want to do this thing? And he said, no. said, sounds too hard. That's too hard. I don't think we're ready for that kind of thing. I said, well, too late. We're signed up. So you're doing it. And then here we are 15 years later.
That's so crazy.
So that's essentially, that's the journey into film, into the 48.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean,
and leaving a lot out.
Oh yeah, well,
substantial amount.
With the three of us, we could go on for hours and hours and hours of inside jokes and gripes and complaints. And but with Filmapalooza having recently occurred, we were bummed that you and Steve couldn't be there
because
our tradition didn't continue. We are the three with the tattoos. We are the first three tattoos.
Hey, that one was from LA. Yeah, that was Venice Beach, and there you go, Rotterdam.
Yep. There's a logo right there.
Yeah. So now they got to go and change it all. Jeez.
No, we have the 48-hour classic logo. Yeah.
We're vintage now, boys. Yeah. We're vintage.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like what? Well, but we did commemorate, so it was good.
Yeah, well, because you and I were talking about it, we were gonna do it at Orlando in 2019.
Yeah,
but I was swamped running the screenings.
Yeah,
and like the one window of opportunity we had, we couldn't make it happen.
No. Oh yeah, yeah, because we tried.
We tried.
We did try, and then we're like, blah, blah, blah. And like, oh, yeah, there was a lot of like, couldn't walk in. And it was,
it was just like way too much. And just my window of opportunity was very limited. And we couldn't get Laura to commit to it. But then, you know, fast forward a year to Rotterdam.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to do it this year. We're going to do it. I'm not working. So, and Laura didn't want to do it again. And then we just saw Indra at the registration desk and saw tattoos and went, you, you're getting a tattoo with us.
You're with us. You're with us. And look at you now. See, like, had we not forced you to get one of those 48 tattoos? You know?
Well, it was a very simple decision because, like both of you guys, 48 has been in my DNA and part of my life since, 2011, so about 11 years. So it was a no-brainer that I was going to do this, and especially new with you guys. And then, you know, having the camera crew there and having the news articles and everybody wanted to take a picture of it, and it was mental.
Bob's son did our tattoos.
Yeah. So we went to, for best listeners, they will know Tattoo Bowl. It's a very famous shop in Rotterdam, and we all had ours done by his son, which is really nice. So. There you go. Remember, boys, we're doing a podcast. This is sound. So what is happening now is that Kirk's holding up a pen from the tattoo shop.
Wait, this is a podcast?
Yeah, it's going to be a podcast.
Why did I get all gussied up?
Oh, you got as gussied up as I did. Look.
Hey, I'm just tearing my t-shirt. I'm not about anything.
I didn't know I was not supposed to wear a tux.
Indra and I planned that. We planned it.
Yeah, wow.
Let's fuck with the Canadian.
We all look really, really good. Yeah. Wish you guys could see us.
We have great faces for radio. It's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Whoa. Ooh, ouch. You said this wasn't going to be like Howard Stern.
No, just joking. God, I love you. You know this. So now, because you started doing the 48 and now you actually earn your living by working on TV shows. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Ah. Wow, there's not really much to tell.
Well, try.
Well, I think it's good to tell because I don't think a lot of people realize that you can make a living doing this.
Yeah.
You know, because there's so much, you know, people are like, oh, I want to direct a big movie. I want to be a director. I want to be, you know, writer. I want to be a showrunner.
Yeah.
But that's not, there's only so many spots for that, but you can carve out a living in this industry almost no matter where you are.
Yeah, no, I was actually, it was funny. I was talking to a friend of mine that I used to work with at the bar, and her husband, he works in television as well, film and television, and he's on a bunch of different shows. He's moving over. She's like, oh yeah, he's moving over to Murdoch. I don't know if you know what Murdoch Mysteries is.
No.
No, Murdoch Mysteries. It's an ITV show. It's really huge in the UK and Canada. So it's Murdoch Mysteries. It's a mystery show. It takes place in Toronto during turn of the century kind of stuff like that into the 1920s. Frankie Drake Mysteries also kind of follows in line there. But so we're at the studio. Like, it's going into its, like, I think, like 15th season or something.
Oh,
like
that. Wow.
It's been on forever. It's been on forever. And it's like, you know, it's a co-production between ITV and CBC. But with Shaftesbury Productions being involved. But he's been doing working in television as long as I've known him. I guess must be going on like 7-8 years. But he's just doing, he's the location.
Oh, that's a very important job.
He does location. And so locations and does some PA stuff and whatnot. So, but again, you can make a decent living even just doing locations. Like, even like if you're like a studio manager, you're just, you know, you can be there and carve out like a really good living and be making, you know, 70 grand like a year just to like, you know, you're taking care of the studio.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of the hours are long and you have to deal with like all sorts of productions and stuff like that. But you can carve out a really good living and doing something interesting. Like, you know, there's downtimes and then there's uptimes and then all that kind of stuff. But like, again, there are so many jobs on set. They're like any production, like any major production, like television series I'm currently on, there's at least usually about 70, 80 people on set a day.
Yeah.
But that's just on set. That doesn't count the accountants, like the
pre-production,
post-production, office, like maybe unit managers, so on and so forth. There's so many different jobs within like just like a film or television.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like, I'll go to a rental place. Like, if I drive over, I'm going to pick up some lights or something. I get into the rental place. They ask me which production I'm on. And then they'll be like, oh, hey, are you on Chucky? And no, I'm on Slasher. Oh, but like, again, there's only horror movies in Canada or horror series in Canada being filmed currently. But when I leave the studio and drive up the street, there's another production just around the corner. By the time I make it over to the lighting place, there's another production being shot beside them. So, like, you know, just think of like probably about 50 productions going on right now.
Wow.
So how would you, let's say we have listeners that, you know, have only done the 48, maybe not have been to, like myself, not been to film school or whatever. How would you say that they go about getting a job on a production like this?
Productions like, again, a lot of it's the industry of who you know is always is the film industry. Film and television is always about who you know. But they're great places. There's great forums like, you know, I Need a Fixer, Producer on Facebook. That's a really good place to go. I would recommend going in as a PA. Even like going in as a driver, if you got a driver's license, if you got your first class driver's license, I don't know how that works in the States or Europe, but
yeah, you get what's called a CDL here.
Ours is the G, but we have we live in a nanny state. So you're not, you know, have to do many different tiers of things because you can't be trusted on your own. But yeah, just getting in through like, being a PA is always your number one step. Like getting in on a production, you don't necessarily have to volunteer because things like there's so many productions going on. And especially like in Toronto, But there's a lot of productions coming back out now with like everyone having different streaming services. There's like around the world, right? They're taking off. They're realizing like they need content. So they need to build it. So with all those productions going on, just getting in as being a PA, just keeping your eye out on, especially like forums, like I Need a Fixer and those kind of things. Those are good sources. Get in as a PA and then figure out what you want to do from there.
Yeah. Just grow your social network as well. Yeah. Cause there's been this big, reluctantly, there's been this very big exodus from Seattle to New Mexico.
Yes.
Netflix has set up shop in New Mexico and their state film board has gotten very, very aggressive with their incentives. And I mean, there's a ton of Seattle 48ers that they've taken, the network they've built here, and a lot of them through the 48, they met each other or through theater or, some of the other organizations, and they're all helping each other get work at Netflix.
Exactly. Well, that would go for the same within the 48 here. Like there's people who are working on productions, and that like our 48 community is huge, that everyone talks, especially like now that we're back in the theaters. Thankfully, one of the main parts is after the show, going to the bar and talking to everybody.
Yeah,
exactly. And that is a huge, that social interaction does wonders.
Yeah.
And people meet everyone. People are on productions with everyone. Like, it doesn't matter where I go, which production I'm on. People know the 48.
Yeah.
They know the 48. Or be like, I'm driving one of the actresses the other day. And she's like, oh, yeah, my friends just won last year. They were just in Washington. I'm like, there you go. Yeah. So it's, there's a lot of notoriety for it. And there is a great community of like filmmakers that are working within the industry and get you leads. It's always about keep talking to people and get your leads where you can. And you never know, if you mesh well with somebody, they'll take them. If they need somebody, they'll take you with them.
Yeah.
And be like, hey, you know what? I got this show on, and hey, you want to come over with me? And it might be only a PA job or something like that, but you can always move up if you want to do more stuff in the camera and or whatnot, or you want to go into lighting, you want to go to electrics, you want to go to the list is endless, but PAing is always the start.
Yeah. And you get such a great high level overview of a production.
Yeah.
From being a PA, you're, undervalued as a PA,
but
really do get a good overview.
It's interesting, there's a kind of slightly different sense here. Some of it's kind of changed, that like PAs are slightly a bit more respected on certain shows that I've been on than others, and I find that PAs are not getting such a bad rap on some of the series that are within Toronto, because everybody there started out as a PA. And there's a hierarchy. Of course, there's always a hierarchy, but it doesn't seem as bad.
Yeah, we have a company here called Go For Nuge, and they do a lot of production support. And it was all started by this guy, Dave Nugent. So if you need a trailer, for a shoot, you go to Dave. If you need craft services, tents and tables and chairs, you need walkies, you name it, you go to Gopher Nuge, and you see the Gopher Nuge stickers on everything on a set. This is one guy started this thing, and he built it into this empire, and he actually has a PA certification course that he's been running for a few years now, so that the quality of the PAs coming out, they're all going to know what switch to two means. they know to say, all right, I'm going to go 10-2, going to go 10-1.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they're going to come out with this level of professionalism for essentially these entry-level jobs in the industry.
Yeah.
But they're going to show up on set. They're going to be professional. They're going to know what they're doing and, make their way into the industry a little more easily.
Exactly.
Because they've taken the role of production assistant seriously enough to get this training, and they're going to show up on set and they're going to be perceived respectfully, treated respectfully. And if they say, hey, you know, I've always wanted to get into the camera department, you know, just going to be taken a little more seriously with that request, with that level of professionalism.
Yeah, I'm all right. Well, why don't you PA or shadow?
Yeah.
Yeah. Here and, you know,
come down to the shop, help me build a rig.
I think because I did take a few years off because I was running other festivals as well. And I think COVID kind of hit me in a really weird way. Like, you know, I had other management deals, you know, and stuff. So everything kind of went away. And, you know, and I'm like, no, well, keep the 48 will still go on. See, you know, that's keep the focus of the 48. And the 48, you know, that's the one. It's the one that's tattooed on my body, the one I wear on my sleeve. It is the one that represents me. So it's like, okay, pull focus into that. And then coming back out of COVID, it's like, you know what? It's to not be doing like anything in film and television, like the rest of the year. There's a reason I went to school for it. There's a reason it's been in my life, my whole entire life.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I know where I need to be. And so it was like, okay, let's just go back and start over again.
And I was super excited when you said, like, hey, I'm working on shows again. It's like, right on. Yeah. That's,
you know,
that's where you should be.
Yeah. Mm. It's taken too much time. Everybody wants to be the director, you know?
Yeah.
But it's when you realize that perhaps not everybody
should be a director.
You can be a director, direct your own thing, but maybe you don't necessarily want to do the show. You know, I don't necessarily, you know, like, it, do I really want to deal with somebody else's vision? You know, I'll just go work on something. I'll just go work on somebody else. You get a paycheck. Yeah.
I like doing the digital loader media manager stuff because show up, get paid well, stress out while everything's being transferred. And at the end of the day, as long as I know that all those bits and bytes have transferred safely, I walk away. I got no more emotional or creative responsibility to it. And it's nice and it pays well.
You might be the last one out, but.
Oh, yeah, always.
You might be the last one out. Well, no, you're not the last
location manager.
Whoever you're giving the drives to.
Yeah.
The last one out.
That's going to vary wildly by production. I just remember talking with my brother once. He just didn't understand the industry that I'm in. And very much shared, you know, like my parents' sensibilities that, oh, it's just a pipe dream. Like, you know, if you're working it in it, you want to be famous or something. And I've never wanted to be famous.
No, just
and I was like, okay, my brother is an avid TV watcher. I mean, sports, reality TV, comedy. And one night we're just, you know, out in his backyard drinking beer, watching, you know, Mythbusters or something. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, you see all of these names scrolling across the screen, except for the interns.
Yeah.
They all got paid to work on this show. And think about all the shows you watch.
Yeah.
Those are all people getting paid. And there's you know, dozens, if not hundreds, in some of the credits you watch.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And they're all making a living doing it. So it's there to be had.
Exactly. And it might be good to mention that not all of them went to actually like film school.
Yeah.
I make my living in this industry. I mean, right now, more so as a subtitler than as a production producer person. But I never went to film school. I went to 48.
Well, you know, you look at it, but the best kind of film school is the 48.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's my point.
It is no film school.
Yeah.
Yes.
It is, that's part of why we always said the 48 should be, you know, it was such a passion and it needed to be bigger than it was. Cause the thing is, it was, you're learning film, you're making film and you have something and you produce it really quick.
Yeah.
Yes.
And like there is a product here that you can deal with, like whether or not you're dealing with a reel or you want, if it, you feel very proud of it and you want to send it into other short film festivals and whatnot. You have a product that you made.
Yeah.
48 hours. We are the fire underneath your bottom.
Yes.
that made you do that. And the best way to learn is to be in crisis. Like, well, maybe not crisis essentially, but that could be the bad choice of words, but
metaphorically like, under fire,
metaphorically under fire. But yeah, no, you get thrown in and said, make this, make it happen. You got 48 hours and yeah. And like, don't second guess yourself. Keep going.
Yeah.
It's one of the best ways to learn. You know, it's like, hey, you got to figure it out on the fly. You don't have time to worry about it and cry over it. And then like, I've had people leave like, oh, you know what? We can't do it. You know, we got to go get it like, you know, color corrected. I'm going to send it to Mexico. It's going to take a week. I'm like, that's not what 48 is. it's not yet.
You get that one stop shop editor who can do the color grade for you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. to quote Steve Nash, this is not the 1 week hour in the 1 week film project.
Yes,
this, the 48 hour.
Yeah, embrace the limitations. That's what I always say. Embrace the limitations.
And the thing is, like, the best way to learn anything is like film school. Yes, I went to film school, but it's not a necessity to work in the film industry.
I got two names for you: Peter Jackson, Sam Raimi.
Yeah.
Oh, a third: Steven Spielberg. He didn't go to film school.
Fourth: Quentin Tarantino.
Are you sure Spielberg didn't go to film?
He didn't.
School?
No, he hung out at USC.
Oh, okay.
He was friends with.
I'm like, wasn't there a whole like USC thing? Yeah.
Yeah. No, he just basically hung out with all the students at USC, like Lucas and.
Yeah.
Because
that's why I was like, wait a second, there's something there. Yeah. But again, yeah, he learned from being on set.
Yeah, doing it.
You know, doing it in like that's the best way to learn. Even within a film school that I went to, it was like, again, there's the background and the paperwork, which apparently I'm really good at. So I didn't like it at the time. I'm like, no, I'm a director. I'm only ever going to be a director. But apparently I could work in the office really well. but yeah, it's the best way to learn is do it.
I took a 40-week program, a certificate program at the Seattle Film Institute, because there was no real serious, you know, like USC, UCLA, New York, you know, NYU level film program here. And I've always subscribed to you get out of your education what you put into it. And I was like, 40-week program, crash course. Yeah, I'm going to get a lot out of it, which I did. And you know, basically every weekend if I wasn't working on a project for school, I was volunteering on someone's set.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was learning the lingo where I could say crazy stuff like, you know, grab a platypus, shove a Phil Collins on it and stick it on a Gary Coleman.
Oh, for listeners, if you could see my face right now, I have no idea what he just said.
I said, basically take a big bounce card, put it in this clamp called platypus, and a Gary Coleman is a short C-stand.
Wow.
I learned something new. I didn't know
that. I've also heard.
That's highly racist.
Well, no, just Gary Coleman was short. And, you know, the bounce card is called a Phil Collins because it's big, white, and square.
None of any of that is right. I think you somehow offended platypuses at the same time.
And I gotta say, the one that I heard for the first time on a set, can you pull out the butt plug and put in a lollipop?
Yeah, yeah.
I was like, what the hell was I just asked to do?
By what kind of shit was it?
It was a sci-fi short film.
Right. But it's
basically on a certain type of stand, there's adapters you can put in.
Sex Wars?
Yeah, Star Sex Wars.
Star Sex Wars into the Boob Galaxy. Is that what it is?
But it's basically take out this adapter and put in a gobo head that's large. It looks like a lollipop.
Yeah.
And then my favorite thing I ever said, it was a short film and I was working on a extracurricular short while in school. I was a gaffer and I'm lighting a close-up for this 7-year-old girl. And, you know, my hair was like down to my ass and I had, you know, long scraggly beard. And I'm like crouching over the table, looking at her, just trying to get a good sense of the light, looking straight in her eyes. And I said, all right, let's kill the baby and kick her with a midget.
What?
Basically, all I did was, all I said was, turn that light off and turn that light on. But let's kill the baby and kick her with a midget.
I would like to ask the listeners to leave a comment if you ever heard any of this before, except from Europe. I don't know these terms.
Like a midget is a brand of light,
yeah,
that you could use.
Oh, okay.
I could have also said, kill the baby, and baby just means a baby 1K light. And I could have said, you know, kill the baby and kick her with a Joker. There's another brand of light. But I said that, and it's just the look on her face. She's 7 years old, and I look terrifying.
Yeah.
And she's, her eyes, and luckily there was a Santa Claus on set. And so Santa came over and explained it to her, which was helpful. But the lingo on set is always fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, hey, we're running out of time here for this episode.
Are we?
Yeah. But
I think you could probably edit the last 10 minutes just right there. Probably should not go to air.
Bonus episode.
We'll give it a special age range.
Yeah, that should be this subscribe to here.
So to close it off, Chris, where do you see your 48-hour film project Toronto going in the next few years? Where would you like it to go?
To the moon. I don't know if I think living up to the 124 could be it's still hard.
That would still rebuilding. Your city obviously has it in it. So
yeah. So like we'll see where we're at. I definitely feel the city is definitely gonna be up over 100. And probably consistently from now on stay that way. Hopefully, I don't, you know, like I could be vastly wrong and, you know, but I think all the efforts that Steve and I have put in the last years, that like trying to build it and maintain it as it is an annual event. It is known around the city as this is what you do in October.
Yeah.
Like we are an annual event and that weekend of October. Everyone, like all
no
the
boom, no boom poles are available.
No boom poles are you're not allowed to reserve a boom pole, and it's one of those kind of things. Like we've established ourselves as it's the event to do, like it's the go to event.
Yeah, what I want to see happen is there's no boom poles available to reserve. I want Matt Berry to show up at a rental house and in his booming voice, I need a boom.
I need a boom. Well, you never know. They finished the season a couple months ago. So he might be in town. You never know. He might be. We'll see. Like, yeah, because they usually start filming in and around the fall. So, and they actually kind of film in my neighborhood. There's a church down the street that doubles as one of the sets for what we do in the shadows. So, Matt Berry is in my neighborhood quite often.
So cool.
Still have yet to meet him. All I want to do is walk up to Matt Berry and go, "Hello, Matt Berry. I'm Chris Cherry," and him to respond in kind.
And then you say, "Bat and run away."
Exactly.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. I mean, we could go on for another 2 hours.
No problem.
But please give my best to Jessie, your lovely, lovely wife. And I'll talk to you again later in the year leading up to the Toronto event.
Later in the year? Wow.
Good luck with everything. Big hugs and kisses.
Put our relationship on hold there.
We'll talk on Zoom, obviously, in between now and then, but we'll talk in an official 48-hour heroes capacity again later in the year.
Well, I see.
We'll talk informally a bunch in between.
I see how that is. I see how that works. Yes, well, no, that was lovely having me on. Thanks. And it was a long time coming. I guess this has been postponed many times in the last 6 months.
Well, now it's done.
We finally did it, and I told you I'd be a bit loopy today, anyway, so I warned you.
48 hours to go. If you're looking for a hero, then this is the show. Where did they come from? What do they know? It's an origin story. Let's go.
48 Hour Heroes Origin Stories is a production of Media Without Borders, the Seattle 48 Hour Film Project, and Heads Up Productions.